Well, good afternoon, class. This is a continuation of our public policy class. We are in the spring of the year looking at medicine, a continuation of our look at government and economics. Today's topic is the history of modern medicine. So if we review quickly, how would you define medicine? How would you define a miracle? How did we resolve the two or look at those together? I hope you can answer those kind of questions. You'll have questions on this in your exam at the end of the term. Last week, we considered preventative medicine and how we're a psychosomatic union, how our body and our soul are joined together and influence each other. Rather than looking at, you know, better exercise, better eating, better sleep, all those habits, last week we looked at, you know, where good health can come from good news, it can come from a good conscience, it can come from good relationships, and even good humor. And so hopefully now that you've read Swenson's book on margins and considered these things, you have a plan for an improvement even now in your health. And I trust that that is the case. These are gifts from God, good means that he has put in our world. And so even as Paul tells Timothy, whose conscience may have been bothering him as a kind of an absolute rigid purist kind of mentality, timid really, against things, Paul told him in 1 Timothy 5 to take a little wine for his stomach's sake. And so the use of medicine as using God's gifts that he's put in this world to improve our health is something that finds endorsement in the New Testament, in his Bible. Let me ask you a question as we get started today. What is a profession? And who is a professional? Maybe your mind goes to, you know, pro sports, pro golfers, and the NFL, you know, with professional football players, or pro basketball. The opposite of that would be, the opposite of a pro would be what then? An amateur. Somebody that does his sport for no pay, even though it seems like perks and benefits sometimes might shade those rules a little bit. The definition in our culture is a professional is somebody who does something for pay. They're an expert. They do it well. They're a pro at it. Those two things go together. And an amateur might be somebody who does it not for pay because it's more of a hobby. They don't have to do it. It's not their job. They're an amateur. That's not the definition of a profession in the past. A profession in the past was something that somebody pursued altruistically. They would do this service for the sake of others without pay, necessarily, if they had to. Interesting, it's kind of ironic that we attach payment now to the profession. In the past, it wasn't done for pay, necessarily. It's not money-driven. I'm doing this out of service for my community. The three professions in the past were medicine, being a doctor, a physician, and law, being a lawyer, somebody who operated at the bar, and then a pastor or a theologian, those that took care of souls. These were the three professions. In other words, to care for people's goods, if you're in law, to care for their body, if you're in medicine, to care for their soul, if you're clergy and you're a pastor. That basically encompasses what's involved with a person's life, and they're all caregivers. They all would defend and help and restore. Those that went into that, it was expected and urged, apparently, if we could believe the idealism of it, is that they would then do it for the good of others strictly and not for themselves. Each of those being that important, I mean, just imagine, if you can just think about what that would be like and how different it is today. Of those three, if you look at them today, two of those, one in particular, is really, there's jokes made about how much they do for money. Lawyers have have often been derided and put down because of their kind of like scheming and seeking to get money, and they're not trusted. I have a lawyer couple in my family at large, and they are not operating on that way, and so in fact they're not practicing at this point. But if that's kind of the reputation, the way that it's seen, right? Medicine also, doctors are often, you know, put down for their golfing or their, you know, condos or their nice houses on Pill Hill, what it was called in my hometown. And so if you were to like look at those examples, you would say, wow, you know, look at those people getting a lot of money. Maybe they're doing it for the money. And then you look at the third profession. I don't know of anybody that's going into, you know, pastoring much other than maybe those TV evangelist kind of guys that are doing it for money. There's not much money in it. Perhaps there was in the past when there was an official church state and people went into that because the government paid the salary of the pastors. I know there was some temptation for that in the past, having read stories in Europe, in different places. But what does that say about our heart today and our values? If we were to look at those three and say, my goods, how much do I value? How much am I willing to pay? Say, well, they're gouging me. Well, people are willing to pay for it. Find a way to pay for it. How much am I willing to pay for my body and its health? How much am I willing to pay for my soul? Even a free institution like the church, where giving is voluntary, let alone in just, you know, paid counseling sessions, but how little do people value? I mean, we learned in theology too that Randy Elkhorn estimated the average giving to church was 2.5%, which works out to one person is tithing and three people give nothing. Is that how I value, how much I value God's word and the care of my soul, even if I have a crassly, self-centered approach where the care of my soul should be the ultimate good, or me is the ultimate good? We are very foolish not to regard God as our ultimate good, but even if we regarded ourselves as our ultimate good. We live so much for the here and the now with our stuff and our health to the neglect of soul. Well, anyway, at any rate, here we have three professions. Each of them was important. They had three qualifying exams. They have three qualifying exams. If you want to be a medical doctor, you have your boards, or a nurse or such. If you want to be a lawyer, you have your bar exam. If you want to be a pastor, there still are ordinations, though they are so much more, again, how little do we value it, so much more lighter in requirements, typically, than are the other two. Apprenticing, in the past, was the common way of training. When these three were the major professions, say at the colonial era in America, or in the early 1800s, you would typically attach yourself to somebody who did this regularly. You would maybe live with them. Jonathan Edwards' day, you know, you would live with another pastor and you would read theology in his home. In that time period, even, you know, the wife would be coaching you and helping you to develop further as a person. Maybe you're 19 years old and you would pay attention to how the pastor himself is carrying on his ministry. Others would read law. I think I remember Charles Finney, the famous evangelist who was a lawyer before he became a preacher, having done that in upstate New York. This is the way it was done. You would apprentice yourself and learn. And as a result of that, there were actually more physicians at that time period in America than there are today. And in the 1800s, many of them we would regard practically as charlatans maybe, or quacks. But in 1850, I'm told that there was 40,755 people that regarded themselves as physicians, which is more per capita than what you will find today. Well, What is then, what has brought about the change? If that's the way it was in the past, that there was apprenticeship and you would then learn and come to ordination as a pastor, and there was nothing, well, perhaps other, you know, apprenticing and then qualifying steps for being a lawyer or a doctor. What brought about the changes that leads to modern medicine today? In this regard, I've been helped quite a bit by an article in Imprimis, which is published by Hillsdale College, in their September 2018 edition by John Steele Gordon, entitled A Short History of American Medical Insurance. He's got some interesting facts. Here's the way he begins his article. He says, perhaps the most astonishing thing about modern medicine is just how very modern it is. More than 90% of the medicine being practiced today did not exist in 1950. 2 centuries ago, medicine was still an art, not a science at all. As recently as the 1920s, which right now is 100 years ago, long after the birth of modern medicine, there were usually little that medical profession could do once disease set in, other than alleviate some of the symptoms and let nature take its course. It was the patient's immune system that cured him or that didn't. Last sentence. It was only around 1930, he says, that the power of the doctor to cure and ameliorate disease began to increase substantially, and that power has continued to grow to this day, then, nearly exponentially ever since. So we're looking at a very recent development overall. Let me just recount a few things that I've kind of gathered from as scraps of information in various places, and hopefully this is helpful. If we look at the 1800s, as we look at professional schools as an entity, moving away from apprenticeship to actually having schools, the Germans are the ones that drive this model. Johns Hopkins in Baltimore is the first graduate school in America. It's the Germans that revamp the university curriculum and make all the ologies that we know. Science used to be called natural philosophy. Ethics was moral philosophy. But now we know things like, you know, biology and geology and such. That has a large increase then on having schools that you go and you get trained at a school. John Steele Gordon tells us that it's in the 1830s that the first dental school in the world opened up in Baltimore, 1839. And so making professional schools. Second development, state licensure. I mentioned in 1850, there's more doctors per capita per head of people than there are today. Well, now to eliminate that, where just anybody can say, hey, I'm a doctor, they started having licensure. You had to meet certain qualifications to be licensed to practice medicine. People still resist this today. Alternative medicine still exists today, homeopathy and natural medicine and such things. But they are outside the grid, and many times people regard them as quackery. To what benefit they have, I'm not qualified to say. We're going to look at some of them as another alternative at the end of our course, Lord willing. Perhaps the only group like that that has attained some stature of recognition and self-regulation, perhaps, is chiropractic. But even then, there's still some suspicion among some. So state licensure then becomes a big deal as things get qualified and the state gets involved with making sure things are healthy. Kind of as a side note, I remember in studying, you know, for this school and the background, you know, for just laying some foundations for this school, Spring Branch Academy. The state of Michigan, I believe, its law that brings private schools underneath the supervision of the state is from 1922. And part of what drives it is the requirement for sanitary school conditions. That private schools then had to meet certain health codes or sanitation codes, and that they would be inspected by state inspectors. This is part of the movement then for the state beginning to ensure that what is provided among the populace meets certain qualifications and has the imprimatur, the endorsement and approval of the state. Another development I discovered in my visit to Mayo Clinic in the 1990s. I was researching a school down in Rochester, Minnesota, and I'm from Minnesota, and had a chance to tour Mayo and go up in the old building. I think it's the Plummer Building, named after their associate, Dr. Plummer. Mayo Clinic started with two sons of a country doctor, and these sons began to apply what we learned in economics on the division of labor. And so they started specializing, and they also started creating teams that would do research together. And so rather than the country doctor that made house calls like their father was, they started developing a hospital in Rochester, and the nuns from St. Mary's were invited over to be nurses. It was challenging for them, those ladies, to overcome some of the indecency involved in surgery and such. But they were able to square their consciences with it for the good of mankind. And eventually, they started developing a, just like university, research universities do today, a pool of knowledge, a data bank, you might say. This kind of research, which now we almost assume with the research hospitals scattered across America, often associated with universities, unlike Mayo Clinic, which is independent, that's become the norm. Having specialization and teams that focus on certain things, ear, nose, throat kind of thing. That's normal for us today. So that's a development that came about in the late 1800s. Now, if we look at something that Gordon Steele's article focuses on, costs, there have been a lot of developments there. And now we're going to focus more on the 20th century. The developments in the 20th century, as he says, in the 1930s when doctors begin to get a lot of power, how come the costs of them have risen so dramatically? According to his article in 1930, 3.5% of our gross domestic product, all that we make in this country, 3.5% was spent on medicine. In 2015, it was 15%, less than 100 years later. In the 1980s alone, the costs spent on medicine rose 117% in that one decade, when general inflation itself only rose 43%. How do we account for that dramatic rise of spending? And I think there may be several reasons that have led to this. And he mentioned some of them with regard to insurance. One I didn't know about until I read the article. He says, or most of the article, I skimmed part of it. He said in there that insurance actually began as a hospital kind of payment, prepayment plan. It wasn't true insurance in the classical sense of having something to avoid catastrophe. It was more an agreement that you would pay in a certain amount and then all your services would be provided and would be paid for. So kind of a prepayment plan. It was provided by the hospitals, not something independent. That in itself has led to... it's led to the rise of cost because now the one who's providing the service is also the one who's being paid. When major medical insurance, which is a true insurance, started being developed in mid-century, it was given as a supplement to these. And even part of the what you call the stipulations in those insurance quote-unquote plans, some of them drove up costs because... Unlike, say, car insurance today where, okay, my car has this damage and the insurance company pays me and then I can go out and shop around for the best deal on it and then the costs don't get driven because I'm looking for, in competitive pricing, the best price, the insurance companies would just pay for it no matter what at the hospital. Well, that would lead to no competition, and so the prices wouldn't go up. And so the other thing that led to rising prices is sometimes they'd only pay if it was done in a hospital. So, well, if I had the choice between an outpatient service and I have to pay for it all, or if I stayed in the hospital and it gets fully paid, you can see how that would be tempting. And so unnecessary expenses were incurred through this system is what he's claiming. Anytime a flow of money is given, let's think about this economically. If money is easily given, if the money supply rises, what did we learn in economics? If von Mises is right and money is a commodity, what happens when you have a rise in the supply of a commodity? The price goes down, which means less and less goods are required to get that dollar bill. If you flip that around, that means that that dollar bill corresponds to less and less goods. In other words, I'm going to have to put more dollars out to get the same quantity of goods. This is inflation. And so rising health costs, inflation of health costs, it would seem, based on these facts, it would seem logical that if the money supply was easily attained and was given, then costs would go up. And that's what we've seen. Another source of rising of an easy money supply would be an increase in government spending on medicine. With the Great Society under LBJ, Lyndon B. Johnson, president in the 1960s, proposed this, I believe, in his inaugural address in 1965, or when he took office, sometime in there, I forget the day, but at any rate, Medicare, Medicaid, these kind of things where the government's going to foot the bill, makes the money easier, more available, costs then it would seem would go up. This is my opinion. It would seem to be that way. I remember reading an article that has also led to, because the government pays for this and that, but will pay more for specialists, it has led to doctors then specializing more and more. It's interesting to me, if there's less and less general practicing doctors, maybe that accounts for why we have nurse practitioners now that act like doctors used to act. They're general physicians. And so it's interesting how flexible names can be, and yet the concept can still remain. The last development, one more, just before we go on, two, rising lawsuits have driven costs up. When you think about it, how in the world can you put a price tag on malpractice and I lost a loved one? What amount of money is going to replace that or make up for? All of a sudden now we're in theology, aren't we? To make up for wrongdoing is called atonement. And ultimately we know the Son of God had to die to make up for the sin of the world. The Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. I believe that the basis of peace for our world is ultimately going to come when our world recognizes only the Son of God ultimately paying for our wrongdoing can truly make up for it. If we can do reparations for that which is repayable, if I steal goods and I can add a little bit, yes, let's do it. But I can't restore a life. I can be punished, but at what point? How can I put a price tag on it? So we've seen those kind of lawsuits and the prices on it are skyrocketing. Sometimes certain states have capped it, I believe. But this has led to then insurance costs going up and what doctors have to pay. The article says up to $300,000 a year for neurosurgeons or something like that. I know for OB doctors, those that deliver babies, very, very risky because there's still a high chance of mortality or damage. The malpractice insurance is so high. I'm told that only half the counties in America have an OB doctor in them. It's just hard field to get in and to make to see those payments and pay for your medical school. There's just costs everywhere. The last thing that I want to mention in development is the pharmacology. We've seen a rise in the use of medicine and drugs to treat things. That's big business as well, the development of new medicine. In my family, extended family and such, and immediate, we are thankful. These have been helpful. Again, Timothy, use a little wine for your stomach's sake. God has put this as common grace, even though he cursed the world. And it's by the sweat of our brow that we sin. It's like God gave us eyebrows to keep back the sweat from our eyes. And God has given us latent in the materials of the world, the minerals and the plants of this world, latent things that can help us fight against this and that. I'm thankful for that. This has an interesting background as well. In the 1950s and 60s, when the germ theory of disease was first promulgated, you started to see the use of various things to fight diseases and germs. And so antiseptics, a serum for diphtheria. I recently saw the Disney movie, I think it was Disney, but Togo. That was an interesting story of getting the serum in the 1920s to the children inflicted with diphtheria in Nome, Alaska. Dealing with the whooping cough. John Gordon Steele mentions that in his article. And so the pasteurization of milk. Some of the decrease in the mortality rate among newborns, one-year-old and less, went from in 18, I think it is 91, went from 125 out of 1,000. By 1925, it was 15 out of 1,000. Young people or children died. And so that's quite a dramatic drop off. And these are things, again, that we thank God for. But it's not cheap. And again, it's a business. And whenever money is involved, the temptation to love money comes in, as we saw in economics. And so it's always tempting to rack prices up when you have the opportunity. I will not say to what degree or if at all that has happened, but it certainly would be a temptation for the human heart. And so when we put all these things together, there's been dramatic changes for medicine. It's big business. The government is involved with its regulations on licensures, its funding of the research hospitals, it's the way it's increased specialization, even as socialized medicine to some degree. And so government is involved. Economics are definitely involved, as I just mentioned. And so it is fitting that our final course in public policy, our final class in the spring of the year, is on medicine, because it incorporates all that we've learned so far. So what are some things that we should think about this as we kind of just walk away from this overview today? And you're going to do some reading over the next week. One thing I think we should recognize, that specialization and large amount of schooling required to do good medicine, I should not complain that it is costly to some degree. There's an honor involved for those that would give themselves to this, especially as it's difficult today when other things may be more lucrative. And so Jesus said that the worker is worthy of his wages in Matthew 10. And so I would say, number one, that we should expect to pay. And this should be something that we should plan for and ask God for provisions for. It's exorbitant due to these other things, and we're going to need help in different ways. I'm thankful for how structures have been put in place to help us. But we should be thankful for this. Number two, medicine is a great vocation for Christians. A Christian can go into it. It's a service. It's an original profession. It is serving other people. And as a Christian, we know that ultimately we're laying up treasures in heaven. And so we don't have to live for the dollar here. If we have food or clothing with these, we'll be content. And so as a result of that, we can be like Jesus, who came, as he said, not to serve, not to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many. The medicine is a great profession for this, as is law, becoming a pastor, getting involved in ministry. So maybe that's yours. Maybe some of you are going to be nurses. Some of you are going to be involved in the pharmaceutical industry or a pharmacist. Maybe you're going to be in therapy and rehab. People in need. Oh, when we're in need and we're in misery, that somebody would take care of us, that somebody would do that extra special and have that attitude of hopefulness and cheerfulness to help give a little of that we saw last week, a chuckle at a time or a laugh, or just provide the needed help, the expertise that would do the extra research, not just go through the extended continuing education to keep their licensure up because they have to, but strategically look at what is best and do even go the extra mile. How we appreciate those who give their lives in service for medicine. This would be a great vocation for some of you. And some of you know those, even your parents who have done it. Honor them. Let's honor them. Not just by willing to pay, but by our attitude towards them. Well, the last point I just want to say is, again, let's go back to the value of the word over everything that people need. It's not just by bread alone, but by every word of God that we live. And as Jesus said in Luke 12, it's not enough. There's never enough money that would keep us alive. God alone keeps us alive. And so if the soul is greater than the body, let us at least honor those that bring us the word more than even those that protect our goods and heal our bodies or care for our bodies. Let us honor the church and care for its ministry and make sure it is well oiled to do its work. We don't have to make pastors rich. They'll probably end up giving it away if they're serving the Lord anyways to some degree. But let's make sure that their families are well cared for and make sure that they are honored. Paul says those who work hard at preaching and teaching are worthy of double honor, especially those. And so let's make sure about that. I have an interesting quote from Martin Luther that I just want to read at the end as he talks about valuing the professions. He only mentions the jurist or lawyer and the theologian or pastor, but we can include the doctor at this point. He's talking about those who are in business and, hey, I don't need education and I have a business and they're doing quite well, and kind of putting down the encouragement of young people to get involved in the professions. I want to counter that. I want you guys to consider these things. Pray about it if that might be for you and the Lord's calling you to serve your neighbor in that way and bring glory to God as they thank God for you. So listen as Luther is encouraging others to keep children in school and the value of education. He says, "Do not be disturbed because the run-of-the-mill miser despises learning so deeply and says, 'Ha! If my son can read and write German and do arithmetic, that's enough. I'm going to make a businessman out of him.'" Luther's response is, "They'll soon quiet down. Indeed, they'll be glad to dig 20 feet into the earth with their bare hands just to get a scholar. For if preaching and law should fail, the businessman will not be a businessman for long. That I know for sure. We theologians and jurists, and I'm going to say physicians as well, we theologians and jurists must remain, or everything else will go down to destruction with us. You can be sure of that. When the theologians disappear, God's word also disappears, and nothing but heathen remains. Indeed, nothing but devils. When the jurists disappear, then the law disappears, and peace with it, and nothing but robbery, murder, crime, and violence remain. Indeed, nothing but wild beasts. But what earnings and profits the businessman will have when peace is gone, I shall let his ledger tell him. And what good all his wealth will do him when the preaching comes to an end, his conscience will surely show him. And so as we come to the end of this lesson together and we think about the value of education, receiving training for the professions, the value of the service that they provide, we want to honor them, being willing to pay. We want to honor them by being willing to give our children over to it, and I'm encouraging you to consider it. And so may the Lord bless the doctors, the nurses, the caregivers in our midst. We appreciate what they do. And so Lord bless you as you consider this lesson and do the reading for next week. Lord willing, we'll talk again. Thank you.